Imagine for a moment that you're a master chef. You're in this high-stakes kitchen. You've got your flour, your water, yeast, salt. You mix it all together. You throw the dough in the oven, and you just pray.
You just hope for the best.
Yeah, you genuinely don't know if you're going to get a baguette, a croissant, or, you know, a literal brick. You won't know until you take it out and slice it open. That sounds pretty stressful, right?
That sounds like a nightmare. I mean, I'd be out of a job pretty quick.
Well, for a very, very long time, that was the reality of making high-performance steel. You could mix the ingredients, a little carbon here, some manganese there, but you didn't really know what the internal structure would be.
Not until after the fact.
Exactly. You had to cook it, cool it, and then smash it in a lab. It was basically cook and look.
It was all empirical. You had to do the experiment to get the answer. There was just no way to simply calculate the future of the material.
Until, perhaps, the paper we're covering today, we were doing a deep dive into a landmark piece of metallurgy from 1982. The title is a bit of a mouthful.
It is, yeah.
Thermodynamic Analysis of Isothermal Transformation Diagrams by HKDH Padacia.
It's a dense title for sure, but don't let that scare you. This is essentially a detective story. It's about solving a mystery that was plaguing steel scientists for decades.
And before we jump right in, I want to set the stage a little for you.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't just going to geek out on metal, though. Let's be honest. We'll definitely do that.
Oh, we will.
We're also looking at this as a kind of case study in scientific integrity.
Right. Because often when we talk about scientific breakthroughs, we frame them as these perfect eureka moments where everything just clicks. But this paper is, it's different.
Oh, so?
It's about making a rigorous model, but also being incredibly honest about where the math stops and, you know, where the estimation has to begin. It's about the art of the good enough model.
I love that. So let's orient ourselves. We're talking about TTT diagram. For anyone new to this, that stands for time temperature transformation. If I'm a steel engineer, this is basically my treasure map, isn't it?
It is the most fundamental tool you have. Steel is unique because it's polymorphic. That just means it can have different crystal structures depending on how hot it is and how long you keep it there.
Okay.
You start with austenite, that's the high temperature phase, then you cool it down. And depending on your speed, it can turn into ferrite, perlite, bainite.
Or martensite. And those aren't just fancy names. They are the difference between, say, a sword that bends and a sword that shatters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Perlite might be softer and more ductile. Bainite is often hard and tough.
Hmm?
The TTT diagram plots time on the x-axis and temperature on the a-axis. It just tells you, if I hold the steel at 500 degrees Celsius for 10 minutes, what structure do I get?
Now, back in the 1980s, we had thousands of these maps, but we had to draw them by hand. Point by point, experiment by experiment. The dream was to just plug the chemical recipe into a computer and have the computer draw the map for us.
That was the holy grail, truly. Predictive metallurgy.
But there was a problem. A specific, weird feature on these maps that nobody could predict. The bay.
The bay. It sounds scenic, doesn't it? Like a nice place to park a boat.
Yeah, but for metallurgists, it was a huge headache.
A massive one.
So walk us through this visually. If I look at a TTT diagram for a simple plain carbon steel, what does it look like?
Usually it looks like the letter C. At very high temps, the reaction is slow because there isn't much driving force. At medium temps, it speeds up. That's the nose of the C, where the reaction is fastest.
Okay, got it.
Then at low temps, it slows down again because the atoms are just moving too slowly to rearrange. So you get one nice smooth C curve.
Simple enough. But when you start adding spice to the mix alloys like molybdenum, chromium, boron,
right,
that C shape breaks.
It splits. In these low alloy steels, you don't get one curve. You get two C curves stacked on top of each other. And right in the middle, usually around 500 or 600 degrees Celsius, there's a gap.
A gap where nothing happens.
Effectively, yes. A stasis region. You could cool the steel into that bay temperature and hold it there, and the austenite just sits there. It refuses to transform for a very, very long time.
It's like a demilitarized zone for atoms.
That's a great way to put it. And then if you lower the temperature just a little bit more,
boom,
the lower curve kicks in and the transformation starts again and rapidly.
That is so bizarre. It's like the steel goes on strike at one specific temperature. And the big problem was nobody could mathematically predict why or even where that bay would appear for any random steel recipe.
Right. And there were theories, of course. The most popular one was called solute drag. The idea was that these heavy alloying atoms, like molybdenum, were physically clustering at the moving interface, you know, dragging on it like an anchor.
Which makes intuitive sense. Big atoms get in the way.
It makes qualitative sense, yeah. But when they tried to do the math, it didn't hold up. It was too fuzzy. Yeah. And more importantly, previous researchers, I mean heavyweights like Kirkcaldy, they tried to model this by fitting a single unique curve to the whole process.
They were trying to force a square peg into a round hole.
Totally. They were assuming that the transformation of steel from top to bottom was one continuous evolving mechanism. So they tried to force one mathematical equation to hug this broken two-part shape, and it just didn't work.
So enter our protagonist, Fadacia. He looks at this broken curve and says, basically, we're looking at this all wrong.
Yeah.
What was his big paradigm shift?
He stopped trying to force unity. He proposed the two-curve theory. He said, this isn't one reaction acting weirdly. This is two completely different reactions happening separately, and they just happen to overlap.
Two different mechanisms fighting for dominance.
Exactly. He argued that the TTT diagram is actually composed of two separate overlapping C curves.
Okay, so let's unpack these two curves, because this is the core physics of the paper, right?
Yeah.
What is curve number one?
Curve number one is that upper curve. It represents what we call diffusional transformations. This is what gives you things like polygonal ferrite and perlite. You can think of this as a civilian reconstruction project.
Civilian reconstruction. I like that. Explain. Yeah.
Okay, so you have a crystal lattice. To change it, you need to move atoms around individually. They have to diffuse. They have to literally jump from hole to hole in the lattice to rearrange themselves into the new pattern. It's random, it's uncoordinated, and it relies heavily on heat to get those atoms moving.
Okay, so that's the slow, methodical process happening at the top. What's curve number two?
The lower curve represents displacive transformations. This creates Widmanstätten ferrite and bainite. This isn't civilian reconstruction. This is a military maneuver.
A military maneuver.
Yes, it's a shear mechanism. Instead of atoms wandering around one by one, whole blocks of atoms shift simultaneously in a coordinated way.
Oh, wow.
Imagine a deck of cards. You just push the side of the deck and the whole shape changes instantly. The cards don't really change places with each other. They all slide together as a group.
That is a fantastic visual. So you got the bricklayers up top moving bricks one by one, and you have the card shufflers down below sliding everything at once.
Precisely. And the bay, that mystery gap, is simply the region between them. It's the temperature range where it's too cold for the bricklayers to move effectively, but it's not yet cold enough, or there isn't enough driving force for the card shufflers to trigger their military operation.
That is such an elegant explanation. It just it clears up the confusion instantly. But Badacia didn't just write a philosophy paper about bricks and cards. He did the math.
Oh, he did the math. And this is where we get into the integrity of his method. He had to build a thermodynamic model to prove this. He used classical nucleation theory and something called Russell's linked flux analysis.
Russell's linked flux analysis, I feel smarter just saying it. What is that tool actually doing in plain English?
It's a stopwatch. It calculates the incubation period. In the paper, you'll see this as the symbol tau. It answers the question, once I cool the steel down, how many seconds or minutes does it just sit there before the very first crystal of the new structure appears?
So it's calculating the wait time.
Right. And the equation connects that wait time to three main things: temperature, driving force, and diffusion.
But here's where I want to challenge this a little bit, because the paper talks about something called disposable parameters. Now, to a skeptic like me, disposable parameters sounds an awful lot like fudging the numbers until they look right.
I can see why it sounds that way. Just dispose of the ones you don't like. But in this context, it's actually the most scientific and honest approach he could possibly take.
Okay, explain that. What was the dilemma he was facing?
Well, classical nucleation theory is a beautiful set of equations, but to use it perfectly, you need to know the exact physical shape and the surface energy of the tiny microscopic nucleus that kicks off the reaction.
And we're talking about a cluster of just a few atoms here.
Exactly. In a complex alloy of steel with carbon and manganese and nickel all over the place, we simply don't know what that nucleus looks like. Is it a sphere? Is it a needle? Is it coherent with the lattice or incoherent? We can't measure it directly.
So you have these variables in the equation that are essentially unknowable. You've got a blind spot.
A huge blind spot. So Padescia didn't just guess. He treated specific variables like an exponent P and a pre-exponential factor for diffusion D as disposable. He took a massive data set of real experimental TTT curves, about 360 data points, and he essentially reverse engineered the missing values.
He asked the data what the answer should be.
He asked, given that the laws of thermodynamics are true, what must these unknown values be to make the math match reality? It's calibration. It's not fudging. I mean, Russell, the guy who developed the analysis, suggested that the P should be 2 for one type of nucleus and 3 for another. Padeshi actually tested this against the data to find the best correlation.
And he was picky about his data, wasn't he? The source says he threw a lot of it out.
He had to be. This is another point for scientific integrity. He only used data where the reactions were clearly separated. If a steel had a TTT curve where the perlite and bainite just overlapped into a big mess, he excluded it because he needed pure signals to calibrate his model. He didn't want to calibrate his ruler using a crooked line.
So he builds this model. He calibrates his disposable parameters. Now for the big moment, he runs the simulation. Does he get the bay?
He gets the bay.
That must have been a satisfying moment.
Absolutely. If you look at figure 2 in the paper, it's just striking. He models a steel called N16. The model predicts a slight dip, the curves just barely touching each other, and that matches the experiment perfectly.
Yeah.
Then he plugs in the composition for a different steel, N26, which has more alloying elements.
And the curves pull apart.
They pull apart completely. The model generates this deep, clear bay right between the diffusional curve and the displacive curve. And you have to remember, he didn't tell the computer draw a bay. He just typed in 2.5% nickel, 0.6% chromium, and the thermodynamics created the bay naturally.
That is the predictive power we were promised at the start.
Mm.
But there's another weird feature the model spit out. Something called the flat top.
Ah, yes, the flat top. This is fascinating.
On the displacive curve, the bainite one, the graph just goes flat at the top. Like someone took a ruler and drew a horizontal line.
That represents a thermodynamic hard stop.
Explain that. Why does the reaction just die at that specific temperature?
It all comes back to driving force. We denote this as delta F. Think of driving force as the energy incentive for the atoms to change. It's like gravity pulling a ball down a hill. If the hill isn't steep enough, the ball just won't roll.
Okay. So at higher temperatures, the hill isn't very steep.
Exactly. For nucleation to happen, you need a minimum amount of driving force. Fedacia calls this delta F sub n. As you heat the steel up towards the top of that curve, the driving force gets smaller and smaller. Eventually, you hit a temperature where the available driving force is less than the minimum required to get things started.
So the incubation time becomes infinity.
Theoretically, yes. The math says it will take infinite time to start this reaction. So on the graph, the curve just goes asymptotic. It creates a flat ceiling. No bainite can ever form above that temperature, no matter how long you wait. The model predicted this purely from energy principles.
That's incredible.
It basically identified what we now call the bainite start temperature, or B sub S.
It's like finding a speed limit sign written into the laws of physics.
It really is. It defines the absolute boundaries of what's even possible for that material.
But we promised integrity. We promised to look at the flaws, and the source is very open about where this model misses the mark. It wasn't perfect.
No, it wasn't. And honestly, that's what makes it such a good scientific paper. He doesn't try to hide the discrepancies. He points right at them.
And the biggest one seems to be the actual shape of the bay. The computer draws it sharp, like a V or a cusp. But in the real world, experimental diagrams show a rounded bay. It's smooth.
Right. The calculated diagrams have these sharp points where the two C curves meet. The real ones are curvy.
Oh.
So why the difference? Is the math wrong?
The math isn't wrong. It's just isolated. The model calculates curve A, the diffusional one, and curve B, the displacive one, as totally separate things. It says here is how long A takes, and here is how long B takes, and then it just plots whichever one is shortest.
But in reality?
In reality, right at that intersection point, both things are trying to happen at the same time. You have some perlite trying to form and some bainite trying to form.
So it's additive. They're helping each other finish the job faster.
Exactly right. If you have two teams building a wall, the wall gets built faster. Simultaneous reactions mean the overall transformation happens sooner than either one would do alone. That speed up rounds off the sharp corner. The model, in its 1982 form, couldn't account for that simultaneous overlap.
And Padeshia totally owns this. There's a quote in here. This method, at worst, amounts to empiricism.
He does. He acknowledges that because he had to fit those disposable parameters, it restricts the fundamental interpretation. We can't use this model to say for sure exactly what every atom is doing on a microscopic level. It's a design tool, not a perfect microscope.
Which leads us right to the so what. Why does this matter for someone who isn't melting steel in their garage? Why should we care about TTT diagrams?
Well, it matters because this was the tipping point for materials engineering. Think about the implications. Before this, if you wanted to see how adding a pinch more manganese changed your steel, you had to spend months in the lab.
You had to build it to test it.
With this, you can test hypothetical steels. The paper actually mentions they ran simulations on compositions that didn't even exist yet. They asked, what if we boost the nickel? What if we lower the carbon? And the model correctly predicted how the curves would shift left or right.
So you can optimize the alloy on paper first. You can say, I need a steel that stays austenite for exactly 20 seconds at 600 degrees so I can weld it properly. And then you can reverse engineer the recipe to get there.
Precisely. It gives engineers control. It turns metallurgy from a kind of craft into a true engineering discipline. You can design the processing route, the heat treatment, with so much more confidence.
There was a brief mention of grain size in the analysis as well. Did that play a big role? I feel like grain size is always the boogeyman in metallurgy.
Surprisingly, no. And that was another huge insight. The analysis basically assumes that variations in the austenite grain size don't massively change the reaction start times.
Really?
Yeah. Unless you have what's called site saturation, where every possible starting point is already taken, the chemistry is the boss. The alloying elements matter 100 times more than the grain size for this specific problem.
So it really all comes back to the periodic table. The chemistry dictates the thermodynamics.
And the thermodynamics dictates the structure.
And the structure dictates the performance. It's a direct line from the atom to the bridge.
That's it.
I want to zoom out for a second. We've been deep in the weeds of nucleation and flux. But when you look at this paper, what's the big takeaway for how we solve complex problems?
I think the takeaway is that complexity often hides simplicity.
How so?
The Bay looked like this complex, inexplicable anomaly. People tried to invent complicated new physics to explain it. Drag forces, interface friction, all these interactions. Padesius solved it by simplifying. He just said, it's not one complex thing, it's two simple things overlapping.
He decomposed the problem.
Exactly. He recognized that steel has a split personality, diffusional and displacive. And by treating them separately, the anomaly just, it disappeared. It became a natural consequence of the overlap.
That's a great lesson. Sometimes if your data looks weird, it's not because the data is wrong. It might be because you're lumping two different phenomena into one bucket.
Absolutely. And this paper bridges that gap between pure abstract thermodynamics, which can be very dry, and the dirty practical world of industrial steel processing. It admits its limits. It uses disposable parameters where it has to, but it provides a tool that actually works.
That is the sweet spot. Practical theory.
And you have to think about the context. This was 1982.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. They weren't using cloud computing. They were probably using Fortran 4.
Right. They were punching cards or using terminals that had less processing power than your microwave oven does today. They didn't have the luxury of just brute forcing the math. They had to be clever.
And yet, they built a predictive engine that still holds up.
Because the physics doesn't change. The computing power changes, but the thermodynamics is eternal.
That leaves me with a thought to chew on. If they could predict the future of a metal structure using the computing power of, like, a calculator watch, what are we capable of predicting now?
That is the billion-dollar question, isn't it?
Are we at the point where we don't need to do experiments at all? Or will reality always have a rounded bay that the computer sees as a sharp point?
I think reality will always have the final say. Models are maps, they aren't the territory. But the maps are getting pretty damn good.
Well, on that note, we will wrap up this deep dive into the thermodynamics of steel.
It was a pleasure.
If you want to see the Bay for yourself, check the show notes. We've linked the original Padesia paper. The diagrams are actually quite beautiful in a stark scientific way. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.